Welcome to A Different Way of Traveling. This is a podcast where we discuss travel for persons with disabilities and special needs in South Africa and beyond with our host, Lois Strachan. Join us as we share inspiring stories of people who travel, exciting, accessible travel experiences, and showcase service providers who will accommodate those with special needs. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us on today's episode of A Different Way of Traveling, a podcast on accessible travel hosted by Accessible South Africa. I'm your host, Lois Strachan. Today marks the second anniversary of our podcast, 2 years since we released our first episode. We're doing something a little bit different today. Rather than an interview, a more formal kind of interview, I'm having a conversation with a colleague and friend, Jeremy Opperman. Jeremy is a disability inclusion consultant, and we talk a little bit about that and how it impacts the travel and tourism industries in the following conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Jeremy, how are you today?
Lois, it's great to be here, and thank you. I'm very, very well. And yourself?
I'm very well, and thanks so much for chatting to me today. I think we're doing something a little bit different from what I normally would do on the podcast, because we're not doing a formal interview. You and I are just going to be chatting about our various experiences of travel. And I guess, however, that the first thing that I should do is just to ask you to give us a little bit of your story, a little bit of your background.
So thank you, Lois. I'm visually impaired. I suppose I'm closer to blind than visually impaired. I have RP, retinitis pigmentosa. I got it as a very young child, so I've had it all my life. And in my sort of 30s, my already poor vision started sort of slowly disintegrating. And now that I'm in my middle, late 50s, I'm very close to the end game now. So I've seen the full spectrum, except for perfect vision. I've never had that. But I've seen a great deal of the spectrum of visual impairment going through to almost total blindness. I'm a professional man. I'm a disability integration consultant by practice, have been so for the last 20 years. And before that, I was very involved in marketing and sales of human resource products. And I have never really, certainly before I started my own business 20 years ago, the visual impairment wasn't an issue to necessarily color my experience in my workplace. I was very determined to not necessarily make that an issue. It was early days in the 90s when one didn't make a fuss about those sorts of things, and you kept your head low and you did the work you possibly could. My visual impairment is something that hasn't necessarily colored my work experience deliberately. But when I started my own job or my own company, obviously my visual impairment became something of a calling card. It was obvious if I met you that I couldn't see. So for the first time, I was sort of paying more attention to it in the context of other people's experiences, both other persons with disabilities and able-bodied sighted people. So I started looking at life with a greater perspective to examine what they did and had and what I had opportunities to do and have. So I'm sorry, that's a convoluted introduction.
not at all. I'm just intrigued by the term disability integration. And I know that's not really what we're talking about today, but what does disability integration mean?
Well, Very good question, because what it ultimately means is that the opposite applies. We have anything but disability integration in our traditional societies. Certainly in this country, we have almost no disability integration. What that implies is where you have an effortless diversity. Now, we certainly are getting, have gone down that road very well from a racial point of view, in the broad sense, where there is almost effortless diversity in business, in education. There are obviously patches where more needs to be done, but there's yeah. that question. You got me? And so when it comes to disability, there is not that effortless integration diversity at all, which can be borne out by the fact that we don't see people with disabilities as much in our workplaces, in our education, etc.
And in our tourism experiences?
Well, that's a very good question. That's even a better question. Because I think that's really an interesting point. And it's something that I looked at very closely a long time ago, was what are the opportunities of disabled tourism coming into our obviously beautiful country, where we are famous for tourism, where we are, you know, we have resources galore to be able to cater for every breed of tourist. And how much effort has there been in including tourists with disabilities? So that sort of integration is starkly, or lack of integration is starkly made I'm distracted by a cat.
Not your guide dog.
No, not my guide dog. He's behaving himself, but the cat suddenly wants to join the Zoom meeting. I think it's that's in tourism. Absolutely, there's huge gaps and obvious opportunities. And to their credit, there are organizations who have started looking at that. And thank heavens for that. But it's still not ubiquitous. So it's still rare for conventional tourist destinations to think completely from an access point of view.
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, obviously, it's not, I suppose, if I can use the term, it's not systematic. So it doesn't happen automatically.
Yeah.
But I think there are some sites that are doing what they can. And just as an example, the Cape Wheel, which is a big, how would one describe the it's a bit like the O2 wheel in London, where you get in a little compartment and it takes you up into the air and you can see the most amazing things. Now, I had no problem going on the Cape Wheel with my guide dog. They were a little startled that my guide dog, I even considered bringing Fiji with me, but they were quite comfortable with me taking her with us eventually. But, you know, that sort of thing, what would have made that really amazing would have been to have some sort of audio described track letting me know what people were seeing as you go through that ride. So that, you know, the access side was fine, but that's only part of the story.
You see, now,
and I'm just curious about some of your experiences in that type of thing. What are we talking about here?
And I'll happily speak about that. But I think what is very important to pick up on what you've just said is that they were perfectly prepared for me to allow Fiji on the wheel. Now, that implies that there was an individual there who was prepared to apply his or her mind to the problem. And that's terrific. Now, the other interesting thing about what you said is that we don't have a systemic approach. And that's the fact. We don't have a systemic approach. So what sadly happens too often, and this is by no means confined to this country, is that there is often a lack of systemic guideline or systemic regulation which would make the opportunity flawless and seamless. And so one has to rely on the initiative of people. And as long as those people are amenable and those people are somewhat more approachable and are widely enough exposed to persons with disabilities, that might be a great thing. The trouble is that certainly in this country, what we have is a huge problem where the concept of disability is still anathema to many people. People with disabilities being any way involved in mainstream society. And so that to appeal to initiative is very dangerous when they have such poor exposure.
So am I hearing you saying then that because people aren't aware of what we are capable of, despite our disabilities, that there is less inclusion?
Absolutely.
Less of a willingness to be open to inclusion?
Indeed.
I'm finding that interesting because, yes, I hear that you say it's a lot of the issue is around how disability is viewed in the specific society that we're living in. And I don't think it's just a South African problem, but
no. It
also makes me think back to something that you've said in a previous conversation about your experience of the Tower of London in England, which so sharply contrasted from mine. And maybe if we can share your story and then I'll share my story of what happened, because I think it is a very good example of how that plays out.
Exactly. And in fact, I think that bears out what I said about relying on individuals themselves. So in your experience, you had and not that I had a bad experience. I wasn't hit by rudeness or anything like that, but there was, as far my, you know, I'm a history fan. I can't get enough of this stuff. And so I was really keen to see and touch and experience and listen to as much as I possibly could and absorb in the short time I had. But I found very quickly that many of the displays were glassed in and I had to rely on the person with me. I had a guide, a friend who was acting as a guide. Not that he was necessarily a guide in the tower. He was my guy in London. And it was terrific. And he worked his heart out to give me a terrific experience of audio description. And what would have been great is if I had found an individual to perhaps take a little bit of extra care in showing me stuff. And so I had to approach a beef eater at some point because as much as I was interested, you know, you can look at a suit of armor and have it described to you as a suit of armor that Henry VIII wore. But without, and he tries hard, but if you can't feel it as a blind person, that's great and I can picture it, but I need to be more tactile. And of course there's a restriction on feeling many things except for the heavy things that people can't damage, like big cannons and things. And so even some of them were restricted. So I went to a beef eater and I said, would you mind if I climbed over the ropes to just fondle the cannon, to coin a phrase? And he thought about it for a bit. And he said, oh, okay, cool. And then, you know, and then he hovered around and he got into the game. But it took quite a lot of effort on my part to find someone to sort of do that. Now let's hear your experience, because I think you had a slightly different experience.
It did. We went into the Tower of London and someone approached us and said, can I guide you round? He was one of the guys who was working there.
Yeah.
And he took us through, gave us a lot of explanation of what was happening. I can't remember how much I really got to touch of the display items, but what he did do was he took us into areas that weren't on the public accessible galleries.
Terrific.
And took us into some of the rooms that were used as prison cells and where prisoners had scratched markings on the walls and things like that. And I was encouraged to touch those, which was a little bit too much history for me, I will admit. But I was offered the opportunity. And I think that that's very much the difference. And it really depended on the fact that he happened to see my husband and I walking in, realized I was blind, seeing my white cane, and saying, let me offer her something a little bit.
That's right. There's a technical term. It's my own term, but I call that applied diversity or applied integration, if you like. But because he's practically applying something. It's a bit like seeing somebody in distress or seeing somebody that you look at them and it's like going to a restaurant and a waiter standing there and not assisting you, or a shop person not assisting you. They just stand there, watch you being lost and, you know, mooching around rather than walking up to you, can I help you? And when it comes to disability, that is sadly not sufficiently ubiquitous yet. I suspect it will get better and better and better. It's unlikely to get worse. So this is not a bad news story. It's just some pointing out that we need more of that initiative. And what you experienced there was made special by that individual's imagination and ability to apply initiative. I had a similar experience in Holland a year before the London trip, where I was with a relative of my wife, who's a military man or a retired military man, and he took me to a museum. And being a military man, he had authority. And he handed over a special card which showed that he was a veteran, and he immediately got free passage into the museum, including myself and my children. And then he went the extra mile and said, right, my friend is blind. How are you going to make this experience really special for him? And they jumped about because he was an important individual. And they provided me with some gloves and they said, touch anything you like. See, so there, that had been inspired by a third party individual. Had he not been there, I suspect they wouldn't have been nearly as accommodating.
Yeah. Which again is interesting if I compare that to some of my experiences. I find museums are a bit hit and miss, often a lot more miss than hit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of my most amazing experiences, I've found the museums in Warsaw, in Poland,
yeah,
are a lot more, but they are by nature more interactive. And because they're more interactive, that immediately means that there is more ability for us as visually impaired tourists to engage tactilely by touch with the exhibits. And there's a lot of things that are still behind glass and documents and things like that that are not able to be touched, but at least there's more available. So that's the one experience that I found fascinating. And I found that pretty much through many of the museums that I went to in Poland. And I don't know if it's just a Polish thing, if it's more European, whether it's just that here in South Africa, we tend to still have fairly old school style museums. I don't know.
Mm.
I haven't actually been to many museums in South Africa since I was at school. But the other experience that I had was in Athens at the Athenian Archaeological Museum.
Ah.
Because I come from a background of ancient history and classical civilizations.
Okay.
And we were walking through the museum and Craig, my husband, was, you know, just describing things to me. And he said, I don't see any signs saying do not touch. So let's approach one of these huge marble statues and let you feel it. And as I touched it, a curator leapt towards us and said, please don't do that. And I thought, oh, that's it. I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
And she said, if you go back to the entrance desk and sign in, we have a tour particularly for people who are visually impaired.
Oh, wow.
And one of the curators at the museum took me round again to some publicly accessible galleries and some that were not, because they do have things that they put on show at times, and at other times they close them off. And I was allowed to touch and feel 20 different statues, friezes. And we're talking artifacts from the 6th century BCE.
I know. Hey, wow.
And, you know, it was an absolutely extraordinary experience, because I never would have thought something like that would be possible.
Don't you find when you're exposed to that kind of gesture that it's quite moving? You almost get a lump in your throat, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And particularly for me, with the background in history, I was seeing things that I had studied as a sighted person that I'd never realized that now that I'd lost my vision, that I would have a sense of their reality beyond.
Yeah.
Through the spoken word. So having that sense, that ability to touch, was absolutely unforgettable. Even though there was one little lion statue that I touched, and I swear it felt just like my guide dog, which made me feel very homesick for a moment.
There's something wrong with that picture though. If your guide dog feels like a little lion, then it makes me wonder.
Well, so, you've met Fiji, so.
Yes, absolutely. But now I had a very similar experience to that, where I think that story is terrific in the sense of them saying, we have a specific guide, or, you know, we have a particular recognition of this need, and somebody will show you and you can touch with you. That is a super story there. Whereas the other stories we tend to find are more ad hoc. Guy approaches you with the initiative to do it, or as it happened to me in the National Gallery, I was with, we were hosting Joel Snyder, one of the fathers of audio description. And I had the wonderful privilege of walking around with him for an entire day in Cape Town. And we went to the National Gallery, and we went to the big synagogue, and we went to, you know, a variety of places. But the National Gallery in particular, because we were trying to educate the curators of the National Gallery towards the concept of audio description, to be applied either in real time, where somebody literally talks to you and describes the picture properly, or electronically applying some sort of audio description tag to some sort of artistic feature, that you could press a button and hear it, or you could have a onboard device. Anyway, so because the curators were inspired by this older gentleman who himself is very knowledgeable about art, they allowed me to do something which they would never normally have, and they let me play with the Butcher Boys. Play is a relative term. They let me feel, and I spent literally an hour. There's three of these things. They are extraordinarily, they're meant to be bizarre and borderline hideous sculptures of man type or human type, anthropomorphic creatures, actually. And the sculptor is Jane Alexander, and they're in plaster, so they're not robust. And she allowed me to fondle the Butcher Boys, which I did with alacrity, I must tell you. And I was unapologetic about the amount of time I was taking, because they're extremely rich in sort of extraordinary texture. But that was a privilege because of an incident. You see the difference? You see that is not natural and unhesitant integration. That is exceptional, special stuff given to the odd person. Whereas your Athenian experience, the only problem with the Athenian experience, in my opinion, was that somebody didn't let you know in the very beginning. You had to be you had to be told later on by a curator. It would have been wonderful had you walked in and they'd spotted you were blind. Imagine that.
I think it is possible that someone tried to, and we just went, yes, 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 and went on our way.
As one does.
We tend to be quite focused when we travel.
Yeah.
So
okay.
It is possible. I do remember someone saying, excuse me, would you just sign in at the desk? And of course, there you've got the language. You've got the language.
No, sure.
As well.
Sure. Although I will say that certainly when I've traveled overseas, I do find that many of the people that I meet are more fluent in English than I am in their language. So it's, yeah, but that could have been, organized and I,
so, yeah. So I found, you know, so I mean, as much as I spent all my life dying to see the glorious museum life of Europe, and I haven't traveled that much. I've literally only been to Europe once and to England once, in the last 6 years. And I grew tired of endless audio description of glass cased things that I would love to have touched. And so I came up with device to deal with what I wanted to try and at least appease my thirst for historical knowledge, or appreciation, if not knowledge, which was, I actually paid less attention going to museums and more attention going to churches. Especially in Europe, your churches are extremely old and you can get a great deal from, you know, you can get a sense of history from a church or a castle. So I remember going to Carnarvon Castle and going through the museum and being bored to tears because it was actually quite dull, to tell you the truth. Everything was behind glass. And so I said to my friend, what do you, and there's another individual now, and I said, what do you say we just run around the castle a bit? And he was very pleased to accommodate me. And we left the curators and we went on our own and we wandered around the castle, climbing spiral staircases that Edward I had climbed. You know, and I got way more out of that. Feeling the walls, you know, the extraordinary architectural genius that created a castle. And then I did the same thing a year before with, you know, climbing church spires. I discovered that was really fun. The kids loved it. And we'd go up these, I mean, they're not small. I mean, the Dom in Utrecht in Holland is 90 meters high. That is exceptionally high to climb a very tight spiral staircase.
That's a lot of steps.
That's a hell of a lot of steps. And they're uneven, and it was wonderful. When they saw me with the cane, they said, would you consider leaving the cane behind? Because that cane could trip other people and possibly yourself. It was very interesting. And I said, you know, I think I will. And I had my daughter and my son with me, so I wasn't worried. And I'm quite agile and, you know, I'm tactile, so I can feel things. And I didn't need the cane, frankly. I left it to somebody at the bottom and I climbed and climbed and climbed and climbed and I loved it. I mean, the genius of building something that high, 800 years ago it floors me. So then, you know, I discovered this is terrific. There's so much here that I can appreciate and they don't mind me touching. And then you go into the nave of the church and there are catafalques, which are the sort of images of the individual being buried beneath. And many of them have been defaced during the religious wars. And so that in itself tells a story. So, you know, and my daughter, who's a very good audio describer, would chatter away next to me and read me anything that she could. But I was, while she was reading, boy, I was feeling and feeling and feeling and feeling and much happier than standing there impotent in front of a glass case.
A place that you would love to visit is the medieval city of Carcassonne in Languedoc in France. Carcassonne, the Languedoc, because you walk through the castle. And they do have an audio description, one of these little audio guides, but everything that you are feeling, you are able to touch. It's a very interactive experience.
Oh,
now, unlike you, I have a very bad head for heights, or possibly more a fear of depths, but which means that I am extremely anxious walking around up and down staircases where the stairs are uneven, where I can't feel anything except this cavernous space around me. And it's not just older buildings, it's also, you know, modern buildings. So I am not someone who's going to go up high places. I did go up right to the top of the Eiffel Tower. And I did feel like it was constantly trying to pitch me over the side. I'm not going to be the person going up the spires. But I think the point that you're making is that there are that sense of touch, using our other senses to be able to engage with a travel site, be it a historic site or not. It gives us a much better sense of the place, the stories that happened there, that shaped the place, and just the whole experience of travel. But what I'm sitting with is the question, should we then, as travelers, particularly visually impaired travelers, should we be more, maybe outspoken is the wrong word, but more ready to ask?
Yes.
To be allowed to do a little bit more than someone else.
Very good. That's, and there you are. You know, I think I know what you mean. Why I know why you were reticent about using outspoken. Perhaps we could find a better term than that. But assertive, possibly.
Yes.
I think assertive would be better. Where, you know, nicely assertive. You don't have to be aggressive, but nicely assertive. Where we actually raise this thing more and more. And say, imagine if now. So take my catafalque experience. Imagine if instead of my daughter being with me, just reading the odd plinth, imagine if a very knowledgeable curator were to be alongside. I'm not impugning my daughter's enthusiasm, but she's not a history scholar necessarily, and a curator would be terrific. You'd get even more out of it. So a little closer to your experience, you know, I'm assuming in the Athenaeum Museum where you were able to see all those sculptures, did somebody come along and chatted to you as well? They were talking to you at the same time?
Yes, they did.
I had a
combination of someone giving me the freedom to touch and feel, and then she would ask me what I thought I was engaging with. And in some cases, on one of the friezes, which displays the Greek myth of Atalanta, the woman huntress, she would say to me, okay, that's a boar, you know, and she gave me a few clues and said, okay, what are we seeing? And I said, it's Atalanta. And she goes, okay. And then she explained, you know, what the frieze, where it was found and that sort of thing.
Terrific.
So it was an interesting combination where she was engaging with my level of knowledge about the topics, and then it became a conversation, which was so great. And I think because she had the historic knowledge, because that's her area of specialty, it does make a difference.
Oh, completely.
If you're given the ability to engage with something and have an expert with you there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in juxtaposition to that, sadly, let's just speak about a blind tourism in a sense, where there is purpose built facilities and things. Because I'm a diversity practitioner by trade, I'm very conscious of the concept of natural and unhesitant integration, right? And so when you have a, let's say, in Kirstenbosch Gardens, you know, the most beautiful botanical gardens, I'm sure, where they have a particular thing where they keep talking about a blind trail. And the only reason they've done that is because they've grabbed about 50 meters of pathway and attached braille labels to some, you know, nice, and they're nice smelly herbs and things. So it's quite sort of, there's an oral sense you can employ, and there are braille labels. And then they very proudly say, you know, we have this for the blind. Now, the gardens are, I don't know, 15 hectares or something. And what we're supposed to only hang around those 50 meters. And what if you don't read Braille? And so I think this is and I wondered if you've ever experienced that overseas. Have you experienced that or in other places where we have this thing about, you know, where you have a so-called, I mean, it's patronizing in the extreme, but I was just wondering if you've noticed that somewhere before.
I've had certain experiences. But whether it's, that again, I think goes back to being systematic because it's there as part of the system. I just want to say about the Braille Trail at Kirstenbosch, they've done it in an interesting way where you have signboards for sighted people that can be read directly from the path, and then almost a V shape, and the Braille is written on the back.
That's right.
And it should be easy to touch. The problem is I was too short to be able to read all the Braille. I couldn't read the whole thing, which made it of only limited value.
You had to lean over, right?
I had to lean over.
Yes.
I couldn't reach all the way to the bottom. Yes, yeah, I know. Anyway, that's just a side point.
I know, because you actually literally almost got to step into the bed of the garden to reach that thing. And you and I, our Braille is probably similar, actually, which you can time us on a calendar. I remember a funny story. I saw a lot better in those days. Not a lot better, but I saw a bit better. And it was about 20 years ago, and I found myself in the botanical gardens in Nelspruit. And they, in fact, they've done something that many other places never think of, which was they had got excellent, excellent signage, which was a nice, decent font in yellow and a black background. So it was crystal clear. And it was the clearest signage I've ever seen. I couldn't really read much of it. I had to get really close, and I could actually feel it because it was slightly tactile as well. And I remember some of their sort of headline signage, you know, like entrance or exit or toilets were in much larger script, whereas the description of plants and things were in a smaller script. I couldn't read, but I'm sure others could read from a distance. And they did it deliberately so that the sign would be embedded deep in the actual garden itself, the physical flower bed. And you could, from the pathway, apparently they could read it with ease. And I heard people talking about it. And so I found myself lost. I took myself there thinking I could probably wander around this place alone. Because the large signs, I could actually determine various things. Anyway, I found myself lost and I saw the sign. There we go. And I'm sure that'll tell me where I'm going. But it was deeply embedded in the flower bed. And I found myself picking my way gingerly through the flower bed so I could get close to the sign. So I could put my nose up to the sign to see if I could discern what it said.
Oh, my word. Yep. That's kind of good idea. Maybe not great implementation. I think that often is something that we encounter as well. Just going back to the question you asked me about, have I experienced things where there is a part that is set aside for the visually impaired community where the rest isn't? And I must have, but I think I'm finding increasingly that the playing field is being a lot leveled by technology. I was walking around, it was a building in Paris where Marie Antoinette was held and from which she was taken and to be guillotined. And they have a lot of signs on the wall, not Braille signs, not for visually impaired people, but what I'm able to do now is I just take out my phone, open up an app, take a picture, and it converts it into text that I can hear. And I think that does mean that if we are able to use the technology, it does make things a little more accessible. Of course, there's no way of knowing where those signs are, which I think is also similar with Braille signage often.
Or tactile signs. You're absolutely right. You don't. Yeah. If you can't see the thing, you can't find it to read it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And
but I can't actually think of any other. There must be, but I just probably can't recall.
Well, I haven't encountered audio descriptive signs or labels in. Joel Snyder was telling us that he was very involved in a particular museum in Washington D.C. Where absolutely every exhibit was signed in such a way that you knew where the signs were. There was something of a family feel. So when you wandered around, even if you were blind, the guidelines or the guide ropes or whatever, or maybe the tactile paving would take you, I'm not sure. But the point is that you were able to discern logically where the sign was or the label was. And then you pressed a button and then it spoke. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that it could disturb other people or there could be other people doing the same thing. But it is a solution. And as you say, with our phones, everybody has a phone. And there are numerous opportunities here for technological assistance in creating something special. I was with Joel being there at the National Gallery, for instance. I mean, he stood in front of a large picture. To my shame, I can't remember the picture, but he took trouble. He took 15 minutes to talk me through that picture in beautiful detail. It was lost because it was such a rich day and there was just so much, which is why I don't have it. But what I've got is I've got a collection that Joel gave me of a few examples of how one can apply audio description to exhibits. And so there are some very well-known pieces. Titian's famous thing, Venus and Adonis, you recall the painting, I'm sure. And, you know, I've got an audio description and an MP3 link on that. And that came from that museum, or not that museum, but that came from a museum. And imagine how wonderful it would be if you would look through the catalog of a museum as a blind person in advance on the website and to familiarize yourself with exhibits and this takes us to virtual touring, doesn't it?
It does indeed, because I think that is an area that is still very much in its infancy.
And I think Corona has probably kick-started it, though, in terms of an opportunity. So we're not going to be able to feel the stuff, obviously, but there's no reason we shouldn't get the richest description of some of the more beautiful pieces.
Absolutely. And I know there are a number of museums that are either introducing this kind of audio descriptive engagement with art pieces. And I think it's a really great step forward. I mean, obviously, we need to look at how we can make people more aware of that across the world.
Yeah.
To bring it so that it becomes part of the system of every museum, every art gallery. I will say, walking around one of the big, it wasn't the Louvre, it was one of the other big art galleries in Paris.
Yeah.
Was possibly my least favorite travel experience ever, because you're just walking past picture after picture after picture.
No.
And sure, I could have said to Craig, just slow down and tell me about the pictures. But I was at the end of a very long day of walking Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be quite honest, I wasn't actually in the mood for it. But, well, you know.
No, so, I do.
How do we make it, that sort of thing, more part of the travel experience from the tourist service provider's side?
Yeah, and I think what needs to happen is that there needs to be more openness, and you know, rather than hide their light under a bushel, and only when you inquire do they suddenly announce, oh look, we've got this thing actually for the blind. Imagine if you use that as an attraction. We have the most blind-friendly museum experience you'll ever. Now you put that out there, and now it's a courageous thing to do, and the chances are it would be terrific. You know, you can argue about whether it was absolutely the best, and only competition will tell. But at the moment, certainly in this country, and I'm very sad about our country, because we, we have very little appreciation for this potential market. The few times I know the National Gallery used to phone up the blind school in Athlone and phone up the Athlone School for the Blind, and phone up Worcester School for the Pioneer School for the Blind and say, right guys, we have an exhibition for you. And that's the operative word, for you. And so they would duly rock up in their buses and then they would be taken past everything that they could damage in inverted commas to a little room at the back where they've got a few exhibits that couldn't possibly be hurt by anybody, and they let the kids rip and they talk to them a little bit and then they chase the kids away. And that was their idea of inclusion, and that's not inclusion at all.
Yes.
So I know this sometimes sounds negative, but this is terrific opportunity, you know, to play and to get clever with this stuff. And at the end of the day, it's a hard job because what we're dealing with here is society's general lack of understanding of disability, in general and requirements specifically. Because there has been so little engagement in the issue. It's been very much an arm's length relationship, if at all. And you're asking for it to be a lot closer to embrace some of the more detailed nuances that we take for granted, and they don't. Eh? And so, yeah.
I was going to just ask, maybe put the question out there. I mean, is it our responsibility as individual people to start these conversations with museums, with art galleries, with tourist experiences, or is it the job of advocacy groups?
Yeah.
Whose job is it? Where should it start?
Good question. I think it actually does start with us. You know, it's a little like the Black Lives Matter, I suppose. You know, if every person with a disability took responsibility for being assertive without being ugly, without, you don't have to ever be rude. I've confronted many obstacles in the form of obstinate people preventing me from doing things, and I've very rarely resorted to anger and rudeness. You can be assertive without necessarily being ugly. But if everybody were to be friendly, assertive about and just informative, you would. And the trouble is that certainly in our country, where we have less opportunity to be exposed to this kind of rich cultural opportunity, such as museums and galleries and things, because let's face it, we have a very poor public transport system, particularly at the moment. And you know, there's a money issue, you know, in places where you need to pay, for instance. So what should happen more is, and the organizations, in my opinion, who represent the blind, should inspire their constituency to go to more places and be exposed to more things. And then similarly, using an advocacy handle to inspire those places to be a lot more amenable and work with them. This won't happen. This cannot happen on its own. It won't just suddenly happen. It can only happen with a great deal of pressure and help and more exposure. The more blind people that are exposed to places, the more those places will respond. But if only one or two blindies blunder in, they're not exposed properly, and so they don't know how to respond.
True statement. It doesn't necessarily answer all the questions, but I think we've explored a number of different areas of the reality of traveling as a visually impaired person. So, yeah.
No, that's good. I think these conversations are important. You know, they can't all be sweetness and light. One has to, you can't always expect, you know, good news stories, because good news stories are terrific and they're important. They're really important. But if you want to make change, you need to have a trajectory from one thing to another. And if you don't know what that first thing is, then you can't really achieve the second. And so it's important that we highlight where the faults lie in order to fix them. I'm excited by these kinds of conversations because the more times we have them, the more things will change.
Absolutely. And I think the good news stories are important to get out because it does raise a few more people's perceptions every single time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely. Good.
Jeremy, thank you so much. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jeremy Opperman. It's quite likely that I'll invite him back onto the podcast because I'd love to dig into the topic of travel with a guide dog, a topic that he has significant experience. Moving on to this week's travel quote. In the very first episode of the podcast, I mentioned that when I was about 6 years old, I had a goal of going everywhere in the world and meeting everyone. And I think today's quotation is almost designed just for me. Melody Truong said, "I'm in love with cities I've never been to and people I've never met." Thanks so much for joining us on the episode today. And we'll see you next time.
That's it from us for this time. You can find Accessible South Africa on the web at accessiblesouthafrica.co.za, on Facebook and Instagram at Accessible South Africa, and on Twitter at AccessibleSA. You can also email us at podcast@accessiblesouthafrica.co.za. Editing by Craig Strachan using Hinderberg Software. Our theme music is by Lu Chil Chow, based on a motif by Lord Strachan. Credits read by Musa Izulu. Thank you for joining us on A Different Way of Traveling. We'll see you next time. Until then, happy travels.